Saying off, okay, there it goes, and it looks like we're live. So this is the debut episode of TOQ Live. We want to welcome you to the show, ladies and gentlemen. This is a brand new endeavor with a brand new crew, and we are learning how to use YouTube here on the fly. Now, Kevin McDonald and I have certainly appeared on many, many YouTube broadcasts in our years, but we've never actually initiated them. So this is going to be a work in progress, and we'll add bells and whistles along the way as this continues to evolve, and we hope you like what you hear. But let me explain to you what, in fact, you're watching. This is the debut episode of TOQ Live. I'm your host, James Edwards, known, I guess, most prominently for my work on the political cesspool over the course of the past 14 years. And since this is, as I just mentioned, the debut episode of TOQ Live, I want to take just a minute here at the top of the broadcast to give you a little bit more information about what it is we're going to be doing here. The Occidental Quarterly is starting a new monthly video series featuring interviews with various figures associated with TOQ, and that's going to begin tonight with the journal's editor, Dr. Kevin McDonald. This show is going to stream live on YouTube the first Sunday of every month for 90 minutes, with the last half hour of that 90-minute time slot featuring questions and answers from the audience in the chat room, participating with yours truly and the invited guests. So we should be live on YouTube right now. Of course, every broadcast will be archived after the fact. So if you miss it live, you can always catch it in perpetuity. But essentially, we want to bring to life the Occidental Quarterly for you. We want to raise awareness of this vitally important resource. We're going to be discussing the ideas and the background of the writers who contribute to TOQ. Viewers will get up close and personal looks into these writers and their ideas, as well as, and this is what really intrigued me into signing on with this project, we're going to take you behind the scenes to these men and women's intellectual journeys and the obstacles that they had to overcome. And to be sure, there's going to be commentary on the wider world of politics and culture, the areas in which they are most conversant. So spread the word on Twitter, on Facebook, to your email list about TOQ Live. TOQLive.com is the brand new website. We just launched a couple of days ago, midweek last week. And for the next hour and a half, you'll have access to me and the original Big Mac, as he is colloquially known, Dr. Kevin McDonald. So without further ado, let me introduce a man who probably needs no introduction, at least to the TOQ crowd. That is Kevin McDonald, a PhD, of course, a former professor of psychology at California State University, Long Beach, and the author of several books, including The Culture of Critique, Cultural Insurrections, and many more. Dr. McDonald currently serves as the editor of the OccidentalObserver.net and, wouldn't you know it, the Occidental Quarterly print journal, out every 3 months, hence the name, quarterly. Kevin, how are you tonight?
I'm just fine, James. It's always exciting to start a new project like this. It's very important, though, I think. Occidental Quarterly is a very important journal. We're doing our best to present very rigorous, academically oriented articles, and we're hoping we can really expand our reach.
Well, that's what we're doing this for. In fact, a mutual friend of ours came to us with this idea. He's the one who actually pitched Kevin and I on this project. He said, why don't you you collaborate with Kevin on a YouTube series? A lot of people receive their information through different means. A lot of people like print media. Some people like to hear it, audio, radio. A lot of people like to see it. And that seems to be where the trends are going now with YouTube. And so we're going to dabble in video and see where it goes. But yeah, Kevin, it's always fun to work with you, whether over the 100, seemingly 100 plus interviews you've done with me on my radio program over the course of the last 14 years, or whether we're sharing the stage at a speaking event, as we've done many times in the past. But it's particularly fun to do something new with you, even after all these years here on video. And we're going to talk a lot about the Occidental Quarterly. That's what this show's all about. But before that, I want to do something that I've never done with you before. I want to go back all the way to the beginning. I want this to be sort of this segment to be a little bit autobiographical in nature. And go back and let you tell us your story. Because I don't even know if I've ever asked you this before, either on the air or off. So before you became the Kevin McDonald that we all know and love, there had to be a moment in time when you became aware of the issues that you're now so famous for championing. Take us back to that time and tell us how it started.
Yeah, when I first became aware, really, of these issues is really doing reading for my trilogy on Judaism. I'd written two books, and the first book was really, you know, very mainstream and got good reviews in academic press. And the second book was on anti-Semitism, and that was a historical, and you could say that you know, may have, you know, informed me about the history in a way I didn't know before. But it was really the third book, Writing a Culture Critique, that I started really seeing that the main forces of Jewish influence in the 20th century really were not compatible with our interests. And I started to really, you know, sort of become a critic, as it were, of Jewish intellectual movements and the organized Jewish community, because especially the chapter on immigration, you know, the other things, like there's a chapter on psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is ridiculous from a scientific point of view, never did have any scientific worth. But, you know, it hung in there, still there. There's still people who still do this stuff 100 years after they started without any empirical basis. But anyway, when I came, that's over the hill now. That's not important. You know, you can throw that out now. Nobody serious really takes it seriously anymore. Psychiatry departments have gone way beyond that. Psychology departments have gone way beyond that. But when it comes to immigration, you've established facts on the ground and they change things. And so what's happening now, I think the biggest story of our time really is importing a new people that and these people vote. You have they have, you know, different perceptions. They tend to vote for the Democrats. They tend to vote liberal left. They are changing the entire political balance of the country. So what immigration has done, my chapter in Cultural Critique was basically on the 1965 immigration law that opened it all up. What that did was it got rid of the bias towards Europe, and particularly Northwestern Europe, because the law that was passed in 1924 essentially was an ethnic status quo. It's like, if you're here in the country now, we're going to be fair to everybody here in the country, and we're going to admit people on the basis of their ethnic representation. That was in 1924, and it lasted till 1965. It was confirmed in 1952 over President Truman's veto. But in 1965, that went away. So my chapter is really on Jewish activism. And I have to say that when I was reading that I did get upset. I mean, these people are taking upon themselves to change the entire demographics of the country. They're advocating it. They are using all their resources. Their activist communities that they funded. They're using, lobbyists. They're using their influence in the media. And so everything is they're pushing in that direction. And finally, 1965, it happened. After the 1964 election, you know, Goldwater was beaten very bad. There's a landslide for Johnson. And that brought in this whole liberal crew in Congress as well. And so we had the Great Society. Anyway, that was what really sort of put me over the edge. And I started to think that, you know, my interests are being compromised here. It's not like this is an academic game, ivory tower. I mean, this is affecting my future and the future of my children, my grandchildren, and everything else. And everybody's children. And it's not fair, really. And it's not really something that can be easily passed over and say, well, no big deal. That really was what turned me, I think.
Well, what an answer, first of all. I know some people could notice that I was looking down for a moment there while also dutifully listening. I was actually getting out the tweet to let everybody know that we were, in fact, live. And the chat room is working, Kevin. So this is, as I mentioned, the first time we've done this, so we didn't know exactly how well we were going to be able to pull it off. But so far, our incredible web team has just done a crack job, and everything is going seamlessly.
Very good.
Broadcasting, the chat room's working. I had sent out a tweet, and I was answering a couple of texts from people wanting to know how they could tune in and join. But what a fantastic answer. And that leads me directly into my next question. When people realize the truth, what do you do with it? And unfortunately, not many people do with it what you did, and that was go forward as an enlightened man and share that truth with the public. I say often on my program that everybody needs three fundamental elements in order to survive. They need food, water, and shelter. But unfortunately, whites need one additional comfort, and they need food, water, shelter, and social status. So many whites in the current day and age live this vapid, consumer-driven existence, and they're completely unwilling to sacrifice anything on behalf of a cause greater than themselves.
Yeah.
We see it all the time. But your life has been so wonderfully different than that, Kevin, and so much more inspirational. As a tenured professor at a major university, you had a life of comfort and contentment and invitations to those cocktail parties that so many of our kinsmen crave, but you chose a different path. What separates men such as yourself from those who'd rather not be bothered by inconvenient truths?
You know, I'm not sure. I certainly didn't like what happened to me. It was very difficult at the university, you know, the face-to-face world of university, and of course, their faculty email lists where I'm getting a lot of hatred, and so that was very hard. But the thing is, why I did it. I mean, I felt that culture critique was not getting, you know, any attention, the attention it deserved. I mean, you look at the first book; it was pretty widely reviewed in the evolutionary psychology kind of press. And it was well reviewed. The second book, you know, trailed off. Culture critique, nobody wanted to touch it. And I just felt that there was something sort of dishonest going on, that it was something that people didn't want to raise, those issues that these changes have happened for something like the reasons I'm claiming. And that made it, so that was part of it. I mean, I really felt. And then other people started, you know, contacting me. And I felt that I could have a life, you know, outside this situation. The academic world has just become a disaster area. I mean, political correctness to the maximum. I mean, it is gone absolutely crazy. And you have whole departments that are very avowedly left-wing activists. You got areas of psychology, social psychology, famously, probably 98% Democrat, liberal, and even then the conservatives are probably neocons or something. So, you know, the academic world is pushed in one direction, and it's very strongly policed. So someone like me, I could never have gotten a job if I was talking like this when I applied for the job. But once I had it, I had tenure, and I really had no excuse not to do what I was doing. I mean, what you lose are cocktail parties, you lose invitations for lunch, and so on. But then you probably lose, you know, they may give you a bad teaching schedule, you may not get a grant, but that's not the end of the world. You still have your job, and it's not bad at all. And so I felt that, unlike most people, I think most people, they work for a company or something, they have got to, you know, toe the line. They can't get out of line or they will get fired. And there are many, many examples of that. People that we know, Sam Francis, Kevin Lamb have gotten fired from their positions. There's a lot of people and other people whose horizons have been, you know, lesson because of this. So it's a real problem, but I felt I had an obligation. I had no real good reason not to do this. I mean, I still had my job, and so I went ahead with it. And I sort of knew it was going to happen. But I think things are a lot worse now than they were in 1998 when Culture Creep came out. It really wasn't until 2006 that I got a lot of static because of the Southern Poverty Law Center coming down there. They actually came to Long Beach. They riled all the professors up. They got really angry. And then they got departments to make, you know, statements about me and so on. And but again, there was no attempt to fire me because they knew they couldn't. We have tenure and I can free. So that was what I decided to do.
Well, I'll tell you, you had tenure, so you had a little bit of security. But there are a lot of tenured professors out there that don't have your courage and your bravery and your wherewithal. And it wasn't as if you were telling some politically incorrect truths that even a mainstream Republican might do, even as someone like Donald Trump might do. You went the full Monty, and you grabbed the biggest, baddest monster out there, and you started telling the truth about Jewish power and influence. And you did so, and you're still standing. It may have cost you a grant. It may have cost you a cocktail party. But I know it gained you a wide circle of friends, including, I'm privileged to say, myself and people like Sam Dixon. Sam has this quote that he often shares, and that is that he knows so many people who will tell him that they'll die for the revolution or they'll die for the cause, but he knows very few that will actually work for it. So, of course, Kevin, your life has been a work on behalf of our people. But the good news is for those listening this evening, we don't want you to die for the cause or even necessarily work for it. All we want you to do is give to it. And that's something that everybody can do with a degree of anonymity. And I tell you, the troops on the front line don't exist without the people on the supply lines. And we need your support. And again, that comes back down to what TOQ Live is all about. To raise awareness for the work, certainly of Dr. McDonald, but the greater work of the incredible journal that he produces, the Occidental Quarterly. So we want you to go to TOQLive.com. Yes, we see you in the chat room. We're excited that the first show has gone so well thus far. And at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Central, 6 o'clock Pacific, we're going to open up the chat room and we're going to let you ask the questions of Dr. McDonald's. That's coming up in about 45 minutes or so. So stay tuned in the chat room. Keep it going. Send it out on Twitter. Copy that YouTube link. Send it out on Twitter. Tell people to join the party. We'll be ready for them in about a little more than 40 minutes, a little less than 45 now. In the meantime, we want you to go to TOQLive.com. There you'll get all the information about this brand new endeavor that we're embarking upon. We want you to go especially to this link, TOQLive.com/membership, TOQLive.com/membership. That's the members area. There you can do a couple of different things. You can subscribe to the Occidental Quarterly. You can order back issues of the journal, the current issue. If you just want a sampling, you can just order the current issue. You can tell us if you like it or not. We're sure that you will. So then you'll come back and subscribe to it for a year. Or you can buy some of Kevin's books, including Cultural Insurrections and so much more. TOQLive.com/membership. There, subscribe, buy products, or just give. Just give. And I can tell you, folks, it's like they used to tell me in church. We don't want you to give. We don't want you to give until it hurts. We want you to give until it feels good. And so that's what you can do at TOQLive.com/membership. You can become a premium supporter, and you're going to get some PDF digital copies of TOQ as a token incentive, as a gift to you from us for that. But any way you want to give, TOQLive.com/membership, buy products, buy subscriptions, or just give a general contribution. Now, we have been deplatformed, as you know, a couple or three times by now. So you're going to have to do it the way your grandfather did. You're going to have to write a check. But the good news is, once you decide what you want to purchase or how much you want to give, you will be prompted with a little invoice. You print it out. You put it in an envelope, put a stamp on it, send it into the P.O. box in Atlanta, and you'll get your product, or we will receive your support, however you want to do it. But Kevin, that gets us back now to what we're talking to you about, and that is the journal. Now, we're going to talk a little more in depth about your work with the journal, when you came aboard, why it's so important, and why people should do what I just prompted them to do. But before we get to that, before we get to that, I want to go back very quickly and just, be a fly on the wall after the fact with your time there at California State University, Long Beach. What was that like after you became so well known? Did students have to sit down on the sidewalk and color in chalk after they passed you in the courtyard? Did fellow colleagues faint as they passed you in the hall? Was there snobbery, cold shoulder? What was the treatment like there on campus? Now, we know what it was like in the halls of the SBLC in Montgomery. We know what it's like reading about these articles that they so famously defamous. And what was it actually like on campus during those years?
Yeah, it was bad. What happened? People who used to talk to me would stop, and I get all these people looking away, cold stares. The people who went to lunch wouldn't go to lunch with me anymore. So, or if they did, you know, had dinner or something like that, I'd be off campus and nobody would see it. And so it was difficult in that way. And the faculty email lists were open, and people would send a lot of nasty things. I wake up in the morning and like 10, 20 messages, you know, and I would respond if there was something intellectually interesting. But otherwise, you know, there's too many. I mean, they were just expressing but what they were doing is virtue signaling. They were signaling, I'm a good person. You can trust me. I'm not like this ass. You know, that was a sort of a general tenor of it. So a lot of virtue signaling. But it was kind of tough. But you know, I think I got better at it. At first, it was very difficult. I'd go into campus and I feel like I was about to have a heart attack. You know,
but that's something that people need to know. And we're always going to be honest with our audience. It's not necessarily easy. And once again, it's something that I also often say is that as much as the price as you pay, and you paid so much more than the average man is willing to do right now. But it still sacrifices, it still pales in comparison to the sacrifice of blood and bone. And that's an analogy that I like to use. The people whose honor we're trying to remember, the people who we're trying to fight for, and that legacy, I mean, they gave so much more than you or I, even though we put ourselves at a level of discomfort that would be more than most men could bear. But they never got the best of you, and you never caved, and you never did the white whip shuffle, and you never tried to walk back your comments. In fact, you doubled down, but you didn't double down in an over-the-top fashion. You just continued to do the work and to do it as professionally as it's ever been done.
Yeah, and I didn't back down, that's for sure. And when I retired on my own, you know, at a regular kind of time.
They didn't go on a away party. I want to know that. Were there tears shed that day?
What?
I said, did they give you a going away party? Were there tears shed on the day that you turned in your resignation?
Celebration or something. But that was bad. But you mentioned that other professors don't do this. I correspond with people, and some of our writers for Occidental Quarterly are professors, but they write under a pseudonym. They don't want.
Oh yeah,
that's the hardest thing, is to come out, you know, and do this, you know, and have people in your face to face world know that, and that's what's kind of tough. And you know, there are a lot of other things, and I think this is not just me or us nowadays, but you know, the whole country, because of Trump's presidency, you know, people are just freaking out. And they're shunning people in their own families. They're shunning people with long-term relationships. You know, everything about them suddenly becomes evil. You know, the person that they like, that they might have corresponded with, maybe even really had a relationship with, they won't even, it's like hatred, absolute hatred. And just foaming at the mouth hatred now. And I think what's happened now in a whole country is sort of what happened to me early on. You know, we have shunning and hatred and people just going nuts. I mean, we're more polarized now, practically every time in our history. Maybe the Civil War was worse. Mm-hmm. But this is just brutal. And you go on the, you know, the social media sites of these liberals, and they're in another world. They're just completely in another world. They don't. There's nothing you can say to them. There's no data you can give them. There's no.
Well, let me ask you to interrupt the great Kevin McDonald very quickly. I'd like to get your take on this. I said this last night. We had Paul Nehlen on the Political Cesspool last night. And I said we're living in a civilizational replay of the emperor that has no clothes, I guess you could say. Yeah. Do you really believe that these people actually believe what they say? Because as Joe Sobrin said, when it comes to their mating and migratory habits, liberals are indistinguishable from members of the Ku Klux Klan, which was, of course, a funny way of putting that the fact that when it comes time for them to marry and when it comes time for them to choose where they're going to live, they live in the most segregated gated communities that they can afford, or at least the most white areas they can afford. I wonder how much of this is a mile wide and an inch deep. I am of the firm opinion, Kevin, and feel free to disagree with me, that when the power structure shifts and it becomes easy and fashionable and trendy and profitable to share our ideas, that everybody's just going to fall in line. I think you have a few people on each side of the spectrum that have true and flexible core beliefs one way or another. And everybody else is just going to do what's easiest. And I think if the institutions out there, the institutions that we've currently lost, academia, media, the churches, et cetera, if they were all touting, if they were all singing our tune, everybody in America would be singing our tune. And it's a lot easier to sing our tune than it is theirs, because ours is based on truth and common sense and things that we see and things that we notice. So I think that a lot of this is very tenuous for them. And I think that it can change. And I think that it can change quickly. And we've seen that in Eastern Europe. And we've seen that in other places. And I think that it will change. I do think we're going to win. I've always been a glasses half full type of guy. I've always been a happy warrior. It may happen in my time, it may not, but I think ultimately this whole thing is going to fall like a house of cards, because it's just built on such shifting sand. But I do wonder, though, how many people really do believe what they're saying when they spout these politically correct platitudes? What do you think?
I think the big story of the recent years, especially since Trump got elected, is that people don't trust the elites anymore. And, you know, he's constantly going after the media. Well, the media is one of the most elite institutions, most powerful, you know, institutions we have in democracy. You got the New York Times, Washington Post, you got Hollywood, all these, you got the television networks, cable news. They're, you know, pushing out these messages. And, you know, what Trump keeps saying is, you know, these people are evils, fake news, yada, yada. And I think people are really resonating to that. They don't trust elites anymore like they used to. And this is terrifying to these people. The old bromides don't work, calling someone a racist for, you know, calling someone, you know, there's just all this name calling that goes on. And so I think there's a lack of trust in our elites that is really percolating down. And people are not just mindlessly following. You know, there's this whole meme of the NPC, the non-player controlled sort of zombie types that we see.
That's the new meme. Yeah, right.
It's a great meme, because it really reflects an awful lot of people. They're just sort of, you know, they have these ideas that they're have been pounded into them in college, and actually now all the way through the educational system. And they're sort of marching zombies, you know, they sort of believe it. But I think their cracks are starting to form. And I don't think most Americans want these caravans coming up here. And the way that caravans are good is this stuff's been happening in a slower way, you know, all the time. You know, hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens pouring over the border. But this really gets people's attention. And most people don't want it. I don't think liberals really want it. Or at least they don't want them in their backyard. They don't want them, you know. A lot of people like Tucker Carlson say, you know, if they could only bring in, you know, 100,000, talk show heads or something like that, then they'd get very upset about immigration. You know, it's just because they're lower skilled, uneducated people. Fine, you know.
It's like Conan O'Brien, who went down there to Haiti after Trump's. I can say this on YouTube. I can't say it on YouTube after the shithole comment. And he went down there to prove how good Haiti was because he was able to get in the ocean with a tropical drink. How many Haitians do you think live in Conan O'Brien's neighborhood?
I would venture a guess at zero.
And so that's what I'm saying. I think they know. And even if they are so far gone, even if that cancer has metastasized so much that they've lost all connection to reality.
And then there's huge hypocrisy. I know people who are liberal to a fault. I mean, they're really liberal. But, you know, when they got kids and the kids got to go to school. Well, you know, are you just going to put them in any old school? Of course not. You know, in San Francisco, there's a lottery. And so if you get the wrong school, you know, you just don't want that. But the private school is going to cost like $20,000 a year or more. So it's prohibitive.
But hey, that was a joke. I went to a very, for lack of a better word, elite or at least expensive private school. And the big running thing there was, and it was set up as a segregation academy. I mean, everybody knows. And in the 70s, early 70s. And I think now tuition there is $20,000 a year. And the big joke was that all the parents were so excited when the kids graduated from high school because they got a break on their college tuition because college, it was cheaper to send them to state college than it was this particular school. And yeah, so even if there are some liberals that are so far gone, the cancer spreads to such an extent that they're just on another planet. I still say, Kevin, and I believe this to the very fiber of my being, I think that most whites, the majority of whites, fundamentally agree with us. Very few are willing to stand up and speak out publicly about it. That's what separates the heroes from the general public. But I think most whites agree with us. And it's just a matter of being able to tap into that agreement, that disaffection, and getting them to come on board with supporting endeavors such as the Austin Quarterly, supporting your work, supporting the work of other good people. I don't know how far away we are from that. Maybe they have to get a little less comfortable. Maybe there has to be no football on Sunday. Maybe there has to be no beer in the fridge. But that day will come. And I think, again, I could be naive here. I've lost so much naivete over the years experiencing what I've experienced and what you've experienced, but I think that it's going to be easier for us to take back what we've lost than it was to lose it in the first place. I think our path to redemption is easier than it was for those who hate us. And the true hatred is anti-white hatred, folks, believe me. I think it's going to be easier for us to reclaim what's been lost than it was for the left to take it.
Yeah, there's a very interesting study showing that if you tell white people that, you know, they're going to be a minority pretty soon, they start to get very conservative and they, you know, their whole attitude shift about all kinds of things. So white people don't want this, which is why the media never talks about the fact that whites will be the majority. Probably, certainly in your lifetime, maybe in mine, probably. If things keep going the way they are, but whites don't want this and they are coalescing in the Republican Party. Now, the Republican Party is not ideal. We all know that. I mean, you have this big Chamber of Commerce wing, and all they want is cheap labor and lots of money and stuff like that. But, you know, the white people don't have any place to go. They certainly can't go to the Democrat Party if they're worried about becoming a minority. That's, you know, the Democrat Party is wholly given up on the white working class. It's all about diversity. It's all about importing a new electorate. And so they can't go there. So they're going to the Republican Party. 1.5% for 4 years, and so it's going to keep continuing. But there's going to come a point when white people can't win an election. I mean, last I saw, 44% of the votes of the Democratic Party come from non-whites. So that's just going to increase. So pretty soon, half their votes will be non-white, and then more than that as they keep importing these people and giving them citizenship. So we are up against it now. When there's a clock is ticking, and the further it goes, the more cataclysmic it's going to be, the more difficult it's going to be to turn it around.
Well, I said that all the time. If the Republicans forget, if they don't care about their family, if they don't care about their ancestors, if they don't care about anything but reelection, they had better get serious about the border, because we've got this the latest caravan coming up, whatever you want to call it, putting a caravan is putting it lightly. But they're all coming, and the second they are allowed to step foot on American soil, they're instant Democratic voters. Buchanan wrote about in his most recent column, people of color from the third world, when they come in, 70 to 90% vote for the Democratic Party. So even if the Republicans care nothing more about anything except their reelection, they would secure the border. It all starts at the border. Peter Brimelow, I've talked with Peter Brimelow about this. He actually did a big study, a big report on VDARE a few months ago, saying how far into the future the Republican Party could continue to win. And it's actually longer than you may think. But the rub is they actually have to start doing something for white people. And even Donald Trump, he'll tell you what he'll do for the blacks, the gays, the Hispanics, as he puts it. But I've never heard him say, I'm going to do this for the whites. Now, he dog whistles and a lot of things. I like Trump. I voted for Trump. He was the first Republican presidential candidate that I ever voted for. I voted for Buchanan in my first election in 2000, and I voted third party ever since. So I like Trump, but he needs to be doing more. And I tell you, he needs to secure the border because Georgia may elect that Abrams as governor. Georgia and Florida, it hangs by a thread, obviously, as we know. And Texas isn't that far behind either. So that's where they need to go. I want to very quickly, though, if I could, remind you that the chat room opens in about 20 minutes, 24 minutes. I'm going to get in there in just a second and hang out with y'all. This is, our first time doing this, so we're learning on the fly. We're going to be doing it the first Sunday of every month at 8 o'clock Eastern, 7 Central, 5 Pacific, on and on. But I want to read a little more about the impressive gentleman and scholar. He is the whole thing, the gentleman and a scholar, Kevin McDonald. Let me read a little more of his bio, if I can, to you. Kevin McDonald is a retired professor of psychology at California State University, Long Beach. After receiving a master's degree in evolutionary biology, he received a PhD in biobehavioral sciences, both at the University of Connecticut. After assuming his position at Cal State University, Long Beach, his research focused on developing evolutionary perspectives on culture, developmental psychology, and personality theory, the origins and maintenance of monogamous marriage in Western Europe, and ethnic relations or group evolutionary strategies. He is the author of more than 100 scholarly papers and reviews, in addition to editing 3 books in the areas of developmental psychology and evolutionary psychology. He is the author of Social and Personality Development and Evolutionary Synthesis, that came out in 88, A People That Shall Dwell Alone, Judaism as a Group Evolutionary Strategy, in 1994, Separation and Its Discontents Toward an Evolutionary Theory of Antisemitism, in 1998, and, of course, The Culture of Critique, for which he is so famously known, an evolutionary analysis of Jewish involvement in 20th century intellectual and political movements. And currently, of course, as you know, Dr. McDonald is the editor of the Occidental Quarterly and the Occidental Observer, the Occidental Quarterly being the print journal. And here it is, ladies and gentlemen. Let me get my screen up so you can see it as I see it, or I can see it as you see it. We're going to talk a little more about this. This is the latest edition. That's the fall 2018 edition. Very nice. Well printed. Well written, and God knows, well edited, with Kevin as your editor. His current book project, to be completed in early 2019, is The Western Liberal Tradition, Evolutionary Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future. Now, why did I bring all that up? I bring all that up because I want you to know the credentials of the man that you're listening to. Even if you think you know Kevin McDonald, I promise you he's more impressive than what you think. And that's a tremendously impressive bio, to be sure. And he puts that talent and intellect into every issue of TOQ. So let's go now, Kevin, if we can, with only about 20 minutes remaining before we turn this over to the audience. Let's talk specifically about the Occidental Quarterly, because that's what we're here to promote. I know a couple of people in the chat room have mentioned a couple of my monologues as being an infomercial. Well, yeah, I mean, you can listen to me, you can listen to Kevin in a lot of different places, but right here, you're going to get good content, but we're here to promote something, and we're here to, and people need to support it. Kevin's going to tell you why. Let's go behind the scenes at the Occidental Quarterly. When did you become the editor? When did you come aboard as editor of TOQ?
Yeah, I believe it was 2011. Yeah, so I've been there. This is probably my 7th volume. We're just finishing up. So it's been a while. Before that, I contributed articles. I mean, I was definitely involved with the journal, but I wasn't the editor. So I've made a sort of a decision back around the year 2000 to write for the Accidental Quarterly, to really try to, you know, beef up the journal and to make it, you know, intellectually, you know, perhaps more rigorous or something. But I really thought that was a major thing. We should have that. If you think about the people on the left, they've had so many journals of an academic nature, but also sort of quasi-academic nature, like Partisan Review, very influential. All these little magazines on the left. So they've been very good at that, and they've been able to get a good subscriber base. Some of these magazines have lasted for decades, and they've been able to really have an influence. I think the Partisan Review, I talk a lot about in Culture Critique, a very important intellectual journal, beginning in the 1930s. But that was what we want to have, something like that. We want to be able to say, well, you know, there is a sort of there are various levels of various audiences, obviously. A lot of people, as you were saying in the beginning, a lot of people like video, they like podcasts and so on. And that's something you can listen to your car, and that's relatively easy. But we should have, you know, sort of a journal at least that has a more rigorous approach, that it is a little bit more academic. This is what this is. And so I, you know, the fall issue you just held up, I'm very proud of it. Actually, I do have the first article there is by me. It's an abridged chapter of an article on European families that will be in my book. I'm almost finished with my book, but I keep adding things all the time. So I don't know when it's going to end. Anyway, it's an abridged version. I published that in an academic journal recently, this year, actually. And then there are other articles. I mean, for example, Brian Thorne is an academic up in Canada. He's writing on the social credit movement, conservative women in Canada and how they thought about race and things like that. Very interesting article, very scholarly. Robert Griffin is a former professor at the University of Vermont. He wrote a book on William Pierce, and he's got a chapter in the fall issue about a play by George Bernard Shaw that William Pierce really resonated to. So it's very interesting biographically, both about Shaw and Pierce and sort of the history of how people thought about all that. Jared Taylor, who everybody knows, I'm sure he's been on your show many, many times, has a review about a book in psychology, a very interesting book in social psychology that just destroys all these myths about social psychology. It's by a professor named Lee Jessup. I think he's at Rutgers or something like that. I'm pretty sure it's Rutgers. Social psychologist. And all these myths in social psychology, for example, a stereotype threat. The reason Black people don't do well on standardized tests is that they're stereotyped, that they're not very smart. And so they get into a testing situation and they get all threatened and they can't. So all that, that kind of thing is debunked at the highest levels of the academic world. And that's what's happening now in the real academic world, in psychology, probably mostly in psychology, there's a big crisis of replication. You know, you've had the social psychology especially. They have not been able to replicate these classic studies, which all lean in a sort of liberal kind of direction. As I said, social psychology is dominated by the left, and always has been, probably since the 1960s or even before that. But anyway, it's gotten worse over the years, and they have these crackpot theories about how the world works, and they're, you know, immediately embraced, and they're all the textbooks, and then someone like Justin comes along and says, hey, the emperor has no clothes, and he can't replicate these things. The effect size are much smaller, a lot of contrary evidence, that kind of thing. And so very interesting book, and it really shows, again, why you need something like the Accidental Quarterly, because there are whole areas of the academic world that are completely blind to empirical data. You know, if you try to publish, you're an academic at a pretty good university, you with a good publication record, try to publish certain kinds of articles, say on race differences, say on IQ, the entire field of education, which is in the business of trying to find good ways to educate our children. They don't believe in IQ anymore, which is ludicrous.
IQ is a social construct.
IQ is the best studied variable in all of psychology. It's been around for over 100 years, hundreds of studies, all pointing in the same direction, massive corroboration. And they just, oh, it's just fake science. And so they go on and they get one fan after another, just like social psychology. We're going to solve it all. We're going to make everybody the same in school. And of course it fails. And then they go on to something else, but they never change their point of view that it's just around the corner, just around the corner. We're going to get it all together.
Trillions of dollars have been invested in equality.
Trillions.
It's the most absurd presumption that anyone could have.
Yeah.
It's since the 60s. And we're further away from it, I think, than perhaps ever before. But Kevin, let me ask you this, because I want to double down on what you said. I don't want to give you too much to do at once. I'm trying to juggle it here myself. Are you actively on Twitter while we're doing the live?
I can get on Twitter pretty fast here.
All right. If you can do that while I'm doing this, the only reason I ask, with this being the first show of its kind, if you could retweet what I tweeted, because it's got the link to the YouTube channel and people can join us in the chat. We got a pretty good crew there now. I think very impressive for the first night. And we're going to open up the chat. We're going to be taking questions from the chat for you in about 15 minutes. But to reiterate what Kevin was saying, and I'm reading this now from the website at toqlive.com. My God, our people are good copywriters. This is good content. But it's true. Entire academic fields are dominated by cultural Marxist ideas. And there is active policing of the boundaries of acceptable discourse. Professors either conform to these ideas or they suffer the consequences in terms of lost grants, lost publishing opportunities, and not being promoted or given tenure. In this environment, there is a crying need for an academic journal. And I'm holding it right here in my hand, folks. That eschews political correctness and champions the free exchange of ideas. We can't let them win by shutting down our ideas on race and the ethnic interest of whites.
That's right. We can't win without you know, various audiences, but including an intellectually rigorous, honest journal that really tries to get at this. You're not going to read this stuff elsewhere. You're not going to read positive reviews of a book like I just mentioned. You're not going to read. You know, Andrew Joyce is another writer.
Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah, he's great. One of the best.
And he's a PhD. He's just excellent. He's got a book review in the fall issue. I think he's got something else in the winter issue. These guys are smart. And it's all well-reasoned, well-researched and everything, and then you look at journals and gender studies and they do the most ridiculous thing. They don't even have observations, and then you got social psychology where they can't replicate 50 years of research. I mean, it's a joke. So somebody has to do this kind of thing. I mean, we have to get out of that academic system, which is just stifling. There's a strong sense of conformity. I tweeted the other day, there's an article in Quillette about academic shunning and how bad it is. It started out with a suicide of a husband-wife team. Just talking, they're doing research now on academic shunning because it is such a serious thing where people will not talk. They start vilifying everything that about you turns out to be bad. You were always an evil person from that time you were born or something. It's just gotten way out of hand. But that is the reality in the academic space. If they get out of line, they know that they're going to have serious, serious problems in their little environment at the university.
Well, Kevin, what's the process you go through? We have 10 minutes, and we're going to open it up to the people. We're the people's champion, and we're going to open it up to the people who make our work possible. And there's no doubt about that. I say that all the time to the point where it's almost become cliche. I view my audience on the radio as my family, as an extended family, and I'm sure you feel that way too. And without their support, we'd be talking to ourselves tonight, and nobody would be seeing this. And I guess that'd be fun too, but it certainly wouldn't be as valuable. And so we're going to open that up in 10 minutes. I got a couple more questions, so we'll take them quickly, and then we'll go to the audience. But I'm interested to know this. This is just a question from me. When it comes time to put together the next issue of TOQ, what is the process that you go through during each issue when you're selecting the authors and the topics for publication?
Well, people send me articles all the time, and then I store them in a file if I think they're of TOQ quality. And then if they're too many for one issue, I'll just put them over to the next issue, that kind of thing. And when I first took the position, I was very worried that there wouldn't be enough quality submissions, but that has not been a problem. There's some very good writers. The fall issue is a good example of that. Pretty much everybody there is a consistent contributor. You know, Roger Devlin has a book review. Excellent guy. He's got a PhD. And it's a review of Ed Dutton's book on people's appearances that tell you something about their personality.
Well, I got to say, Kevin, very quickly, there's not a wasted page. And there never is in this particular journal. I mean, you're talking about not only are you the editor, sometimes you are a contributing author as well. This most recent issue, but Jared Taylor, Andrew Joyce, who's one of my favorites, Dr. Tom Sudik, Tom, an old friend of mine. I mean, all of these people I know well, and of course, Roger Devlin. There's articles, original content, there's reviews, there's all kinds of stuff in here, and it's at an academic level par excellence. And so I think that's needed because it is rare. And this is, as far as I know, the only journal of its kind on our side that comes with this sort of academic heft.
That is true. And there's nothing else like it. Nothing else like it.
Well, and it's got a lot of longevity, too. I was going to ask you, as if people need to know why TOQ is important. I think one thing is its longstanding longevity. You've been on since 2011 as its editor, and I have been handling distribution. I don't know if people know this. So many people know me from the Political Cesspool radio program, but I've been doing the distribution of TOQ for at least that long, I think. And we've been working together behind the scenes in this capacity for many, many years now. And the longevity is really very impressive as well. I mean, what year is this for TOQ?
It's the 18th volume.
And so 18th year for a print journal in this climate where print is dying, and certainly it's not easy to print our ideas. But this is done so well. I got to show it to you one more time, folks. This is a fantastically produced publication. And it's professionally produced, it's professionally edited, it's got academic heavyweights in it, and we want you to subscribe to it. And you can do that at toqlive.com/membership, toqlive.com/membership. There you can order a copy, either a print version or a PDF. You can send a general contribution. Any questions, support@toqlive.com, and they'll help work you through the process. We have been deplatformed, so you're going to have to go through the process of ordering and then print out your invoice, mail it in with your check. But it is actually that deplatforming, Kevin, that ironically has led us to where we are now. We got deplatformed for the second or third time for subscriptions to TOQ. And again, one of our mutual friends said, hey, why don't y'all do this to raise awareness for what we're doing and let people know this is how they can help and how much their help is needed. So it was actually the platforming that gave birth to this. It's sort of like a live-action whack-a-mole game that we're playing here. They beat us down, and then we pop up somewhere else, and we'll be here for as long as we can, and that might not be past this show. But if it is, we'll be here the first Sunday of every month. But talk about the deplatforming. We're going to turn it over to the audience in about 5 minutes. Talk about the deplatforming, the importance of TOQ. Put it in your own words, Kevin. Let me set this up for you. Put it in your own words why it is important for the people to subscribe to TOQ and to support TOQ at toqlive.com. And then talk about deplatforming and how we must endure. We shall overcome, if you will.
Yeah, I think the establishment is very concerned about us. Not us, you know, well, they are concerned about us because we have been the platform. TOQ has, National Quarterly, Actual Observer has, I suppose your show has, I know a lot of other people have. They are trying their best to shut it off. They, you know, I think that, you know, when I was growing up, there were three television networks, all owned, you know, run by the same group, you might say, all liberal. Now you have the internet, but, and I think that is very much worrying to them. They want to isolate it. You see on Twitter, you know, they shadow ban people. You know, they cull your followers. And so I've been stuck at a certain number for a year or so. I can't get any more. I can't get any less. You know, it's sort of like they're doing what they can to limit the influence of this thing because they know that people are going to resonate to it, that this is something that that the time has come. And what we are saying makes an awful lot of sense. So the response is not to really argue with us, it's to shut us down. That's the reaction of a totalitarian state, and that's really what we are heading to towards very quickly. You have to show the word over again.
It's a soft totalitarianism. They don't round us up on the street and put a bullet in the base of our skull wherever they find us.
Oh, there's a lot of people want to do that.
They will try to take away your livelihood. They will try to make sure that you can't find an audience for these very real and very honest debates and ideas that we have. And we're nothing if not truth tellers. But again, we're sick and tired of being sick and tired, as they once said. And we're going to keep on going. And we're going to keep on going. And as long as you've got people like us out there, you're going to be okay, folks. But we do need your support. And it's because of that deplatforming that we want you to consider supporting the work of TOQ Live with an increased vigor. They have really put a hurt on the ability that we have to get this journal out to a wider audience. And it's in its 18th year, so we have an established subscriber base. But at the same time, obviously it's difficult to do business in the current year without the means to do business online with e-commerce. But we're not going to give up, and we're going to continue to fight. And with good people like those in the chat room, and I've been reading some of these comments, with good people like that on our side, Kevin, I think we're not only going to survive but thrive. But in order to do that, folks, we can't do it by ourselves. TOQLive.com, TOQLive.com/membership. Order a product, order a subscription, send in a general contribution. If you don't want anything from us, we'll take your support just because you're good and you appreciate what we do. And Kevin, you would ask them to do that too, am I correct?
Yeah. And you know, what you're saying, we're going to keep on. I think persistence is the big thing. But, you know, the way the mainstream media works really is constant repetition, same ideas over and over again. We had to sort of do that too. We had to sort of, you know, they're from different perspectives, different books and so on. We write about, you know, you might have essays on T.S. Eliot or Hemingway or whatever, but they're all from, a certain perspective. And that's what the mainstream media does. They're constantly repeating. And so that's what is drummed into people day after day throughout their school years and then in the media. We have to have our own outlets to do that. And if it's just sort of, if we stop, then you've got an archive and people aren't even going to, we have to stay up on it, comment on current events, all those kinds of things. And that's what makes us relevant, makes us vital.
All right, Kevin. Well, with that being said, I've never had an hour with you without a commercial break. So this is new.
Right.
A full hour, me and you talking without the commercial interruption, but we are going to open it up to the audience now. So we've got 30 minutes left in this live stream. We're going to go now to the audience that is gathered together in the chat. Good number of people for the first time. I got to say again, folks, for a point of emphasis, or I don't want to be repetitious here, but it's a good crowd for the first show with people, with there being such a saturation of content out there on the market. Now, when I started my radio show 14 years ago, we were the only game in town, at least on radio. And that was even before Twitter. Twitter wasn't even, I think Facebook had just gotten off. There wasn't all this social media content now, even on our side. So for a new endeavor like this, even though you've got two longstanding people here. It's good to have this many people in the chat for the first night. I'm impressed. And I know Kevin's excited too. So we're going to turn it over to the chat now. And our first question comes from a young lady in Missouri, Kevin. She wants to know when you're going to translate Culture of Critique for Dummies.
I'm going to translate Culture of Critique for what?
Let me read it exactly. Hang on, let me pull it up on my phone.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah, could you write Culture of Critique for Dummies?
Somebody just suggested that again recently, and I want to finish this book, and I'm almost done. Then I decided that's what my next little project. I'm gonna do that.
You are gonna do it. Okay, good.
Not for dummies, for normies, for people who, you know, are not really. It's written at a pretty high level. It's an academic book, really, and a lot of people, you know, you have to wade through all that, you know, and. So I'm going to try to make an easier, you know, or accessible version.
All right, Kevin, here's what we're going to do the rest of the show. We're going to answer. We're going to do rapid fire because I want to get to as many people in the chat as we can. We're going to do rapid fire with you. So I'll set them up. You slam dunk it. It's like alley-oop. I'll lob it to you. You throw it down the hoop, and we will keep going as quick as we can so we can work as many questions in as possible. Do you, Kevin, believe, this is from the chat room, that Jordan Peterson is sincere or cynical with his cursory dismissals I guess your work is the question. Could it be self-deception toward pragmatic ends?
Yeah, I think it's pragmatic. He knows where I can go, and he does some good things. I think he's probably basically a good guy, but yeah, he knows where he's got to stay, and you know, he's been a force against political correctness, and he's really hated by liberals. But, yeah, he won't deal with certain issues, and Jewish influence is one. And as I actually had an exchange with him. He wrote something against me, high stuff, and I responded. But it was, you know, it was empirically based, and it was okay. I mean, I thought he wasn't just polemically doing this. He had some ideas, but I thought I was able to handle it. But, yeah, there's a pragmatic element there, and he's very, very, very popular, unbelievably popular. And
I know a guy in Texas that went to see him, and he had to get a ticket on the aftermarket, the resale.
Yeah, I mean,
it's $100, and it was a packed out stadium. It's amazing that he's gotten this much of a following.
The rock star, my God, and I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah. Except for you, I've never seen anything like it.
For an academic, I mean, it's just weird.
All right. So, again, we're going to go quickly here, and we're going to try to service as many people in the chat room as possible. And we appreciate everybody tuning in tonight and for participating. Okay. We're seeing today it's okay to be white flyer postings being treated as hate speech by local authorities. Wouldn't this be a red pill to most European Americans to wake up? Kevin?
That's a great question. I think that should be, you know, it's okay to be white. I mean, it's how can you be upset about that? Because it is okay to be white. And yet, it's not for these people. They go crazy. And it just sort of brings out the hatred that we are confronting. And I think that's one of the big lessons that we're seeing now, is the hatred. It's getting more and more mainstream. Huffington Post, but the New York Times, they hired this Asian woman who's got a history of anti-white tweets. You've got Don Lemon on CNN, and then I think her name is Michelle Haberman from New York Times, Goldberg, saying, you know, thank God we can replace them, you know, we can replace white people. You know, I mean, people are there. They're just hate is coming out. And so a sign like that is okay to be white is a nice thing for people to be able to see, but it's going to be one of those things that's seen as hate, and people are going to be terrified to show it in public. And, you know, it's the same old thing, just like, you know, the frog, what's it, Pepe, you know, that became a hate symbol. ADL actually went after it. But, you know, it just shows the depths of where we are at, that you can't say something like that and have some pride. Every other group is encouraged to be proud of themselves and their history and their accomplishments and everything else. But we are vilify everything we've ever done. The only thing we've ever done is enslave blacks and take land from the Indians. That's the whole story right there. Two propositions. That's it.
There it is. Yeah, I mean, you're right. And that is the most egregious and obvious double standard that anybody could come across. Everybody else is not only allowed but encouraged to celebrate their ethnicity, their religion, their heroes, their past, their ancestors, whatever. But, of course, if whites do it, it's race. I wrote a book about that in 2010, Racism, Schmacism.
That's right.
And you gave a very nice endorsement of it, Kevin. Can you believe that was 8 years ago now? My goodness, it came out fast.
Yeah.
Somebody talking now, how about culture of critique for kids with pictures? we'll let Kevin.
I think there's a little bridge too
far. We'll talk about that. Now, what Kevin is right, Kevin, very quickly, because I want to go as quickly as possible. I'm getting swamped here in the chat room. One person writes, what are you working on now? There is a new book that you're working on. Just give us the title and the tentative release date.
It's going to be called Western Individualism and the Liberal Tradition, Origins, History, and Prospects for the Future. In other words, it's about liberalism, really. I mean, you know, we are a unique people, and we're the only people that really have invented this liberalism thing. Nobody else does this. Where are you going to find it? Middle East? No. Africa? No. China? No. Japan? I mean, nowhere, really. We are the ones that invented liberalism. We're the ones that had movements to free the slaves for moral reasons. Nobody else ever did that. And so I want to understand that. And I think it's fundamentally has to do with individualism. And there's an evolutionary story to it, and there's a long history. Just try to understand the modern world and the thinking of so many people. In terms of this sort of framework, because it goes into the present. You know, the last part is going to be prospects for the future, and the prospects for the future are not good if we maintain this individualistic approach. You were mentioning before that people are so concerned about their own little family and stuff, and they don't consider the wider picture here. And they're, if they're doing okay, they're making enough money, well, that's okay then. But they're not thinking about what it's going to look like in 200 years. What the prospects of their children and grandchildren are going to be.
And that's the thing. As I put it, we're fighting not only for our present, but our past and our future as well. We fight for all of it because we are part of a continuing saga. We are part of a generational, a racial, our DNA stretches back.
It stretches way back.
And far back as history can account. And so we fight for our past, our present, and our future. And for those so short-sighted to only fight for themselves while they're alive on this temporary.
Yeah, very short-sighted.
It's incredibly selfish.
But that's, you know, you see that. And Northwestern Europeans are most prone to this. Look at the Swedes. My God, they you think America's bad. I mean, the thinking over there is just almost mind-boggling. They can't get...
Well, they did give us Henrik Palmgren, though, so we'll give them that.
Oh, they gave us Hans Henrik. Is excellent, yes.
I'm actually wearing... Hey, James Edwards' wardrobe tonight is provided by Lana Lochtev. Lana sent me this shirt, and it is comfortable. So this is one of Lana Lama's shirts. So we'll name drop Henrik and Lana tonight. Good people. And good friends. From the chat room, Kevin, while active as a professor to colleagues, who ignored, shunned, and denounced you, did any of them in private say, you're brave?
You know, not really. I mean, not at my university. I mean, I've had, as I said, I had a lot of correspondence, and we've published people, mostly under pseudonyms, who are from various universities. But at my university, I can't say that happened. My best friend probably was a liberal to the end. really imbued. There's a sort of academic mentality and the way they see the world. And it's very much a groupthink, but, I think a lot of them, you know, are into the idea that if you have ideas like, say, I have or you have, there's something sort of morally wrong with you, and it's something that is a little bit beneath them as a as an academic or something. They're very status conscious, you know, and it doesn't really get through to them.
Kevin, another question. Your thoughts on the Catholic Church and really all Protestant denominations, at least at the head table now, helping weaken the United States through immigration laws?
Yeah, that's very sad to see that. The Catholic Church has a long history, of course, going back to the Roman Empire. And at various times, it has really defended the interests of its people. You think about the Reconquista in Spain. You think about, the Battle of Lepanto, the papal fleets against the Turks, the Crusades, where they were, that wasn't defensive, that was offensive, but still it was, you know, they had a sense of doing something, you know, for their people, and took religion very seriously, of course. But that's not the case now. It's fascinating that even in like 100 years ago, Pope Pius X, a little more than 100 years ago, they published an encyclical in which they reiterated all the teachings about Jews. So this is a really big Vatican II. And there's been a lot of infiltration of the church. They've turned left. We have a number of articles in Axel Observer about that, and the various activists, many of them Jewish, who were involved in this. But it is quite a story, but it has definitely changed. And the problem is religion now does not have the, sort of say, the punch that it used to in the public realm. It used to, you know, maybe, well, especially, say, 100 years ago, Protestant spokesmen were really important people. The Pope was important. And not so much anymore. They're sort of figureheads, and they sort of go with the flow. They don't lead, they follow. And so now they're knuckling under to the sexual thing. And some of them are ordaining gay people and gay marriages and everything. So it's become part of liberalism incorporated, basically. So it's been very bad. It can change. There's some people who have ideas about how to change religion, but they're certainly a long way from the mainstream.
Like I said, I got kicked out of, no, I didn't get kicked out of church. My entire church got kicked out of the denomination because I was a member. So if I had inquired upon Christianity as an older person, had not been brought up through it, seeing the way that the head table was presenting it, I could only look at myself and gag, or look at the church and gag. And I say that as a Christian, as a believing Christian, I say that, and it's a shame that even that institution has also been taken, at least at the head table. And the head table is what you hear when you go to these churches. You hear that. Now you can find a rural church in a rural area that's going to give you the sure enough good stuff. It's a shame. Anyway, Kevin, I was laughing a little bit as you began to answer that question, only because if nothing else, our people do have a great sense of humor. Our people are funny. Our people are good natured and good willed. And there was a comment here that cracked me up just a little bit. And I should also tell you, I am quite obsessive compulsive. I am a perfectionist, and I want to get to all these questions. And I know that the clock is starting to tick. So we're going to do these as quick as possible, folks. I'm going to try to work in as many of you as possible, but this one literally had me laughing. Kevin, would you like to see circumcision banned in the ethnostate?
Certain what banned?
Circumcision. Would you like to see circumcision banned in the ethnostate?
I would have nothing against that. I mean, I did not circumcise my two sons. I did not do that.
Interesting. Yeah, because the OBGYN, when my wife and I were married, he's like, well, you don't want Junior to, you know, look different than his daddy. So, and not that he knew what daddy looked like, but he was just guessing. And so that's interesting. A funny question. Anyway, okay, let's go on. Dr. Michael Hill, another good friend of mine, and I'm sure a person you know, was on my show recently, and he talked about his ancestral memory. And I do believe in that. He talked about the first time he went to Scotland, it felt as though he was at home, having never been there before. And he said it harkened to his ancestral memory. So this is an interesting question. Your thoughts on genetic memory and what effects it might have on Jewish behavior?
Interesting. I felt that same way going to Scotland. I have Scottish ancestry, and I felt a look at the Scottish landscapes and really resonate. There's maybe something to that. And I think there's an awful lot packed in the Jewish genome that we don't really understand yet. But there is a strong sense of peoplehood there. That's all unbelievable. And it gets stronger as they get older. I don't know how it's encoded exactly, but yeah, it could be something like that. There's historical memories. And, there's historical hatreds that have been going on for generations. I mean, the hatred towards Christianity and towards Europeans is, it's mother's milk to Jews when they are socialized. And that's a big part of the problem. When Jews see their own history, they see it as just one long tale of persecution. That's the whole story. Don't ever talk about what Jews might have done or anything like that. That could be, encoded somewhere. I don't know. I think we still need to know something, though, about genetics and how it affects the brain before we can really say that.
All right. How about this one? This was one of the better questions I've seen tonight. This is an interesting question and a provocative question. With deplatforming, censorship, escalating political violence, etc., what, Kevin, is your 5-year outlook for the United States at this time? Great question.
That's a great question. I wrote an Occidental Observer article on prospects for Civil War II, because they did a poll and 35% of, I think, people, Americans, thought there'd be a civil war in the near future. We are heading in that direction. I mean, and I think if the Republicans win on Tuesday and if Trump is reelected, boy, I think there's going to be violence in the streets. I think that they are going to tear their hair out. They're going to just go crazy. And you're going to see, rioting in the big cities and looting and stores being burned and everything. And civil disorder of a very large scale. It's not going to be like the first Civil War where you have, lines and battlefronts and so on. It's going to be very different, but it's going to be intense. And who knows what can happen in a very unstable situation like that. The people will vote for more authoritarian governments if they really think that the situation is extremely unstable. I think we may be headed for that, very possible. And in my article, I said, if it happens, the sooner the better. Because we are in a good position at this point. In 20 years, we're going to be in a worse position. 10 years, we're going to be in a worse position. We have to, we have to make our move. Because the longer it goes, the more cataclysmic the changes are going to be. Because they're flooding the country with all kinds of people. And they're getting them to vote, and they're not going to vote on our side.
Kevin, you're right. I mean, the clock is ticking. I said this again last night. I say it often. All the left, all the white-hating zealots, all our enemies have to do is sit on the ball and run out the clock. They've already got everything. They sit on the ball, run out the clock, and we're done. So it's not enough just to hold serve henceforth. We have to not only win, but we have to get aggressive. And, it wasn't like in 1954 when they got control of the Supreme Court and they put that monstrosity, Brown versus Board of Education, down our throat. They didn't say, well, is this constitutional? Was it the right thing to do? No, they just ramrodded it down. Damn the torpedoes. We have to have that kind of vigor as well, or we'll never beat them. And so when we're in a position of power, we have to go full throttle because time is running out. And to stop the damage the left has done at this point is not going to be enough, because it'll end and they'll win. We have to reverse it. We have to get aggressive. And I don't know if the Republicans have it in them.
No, I agree.
Trump may. Yeah. He may or may not. But the GOP at large certainly hasn't shown that they do.
That's right. If you stop immigration tomorrow, it's on autopilot.
People
are young, they're having children, and they're going to be the majority. You got to do something very quickly and very drastically.
Kevin, listener Barbara writes that she sees all the books behind you. What's your favorite book that affected you and why?
You can't pick a favorite book. Gee whiz.
Like naming one of your favorite kids. How can you choose?
Yeah, you can't do that. You cannot choose that. But I've been reading a lot of European history lately. Very good, some very good books. One by, I believe, Mary Hartman. So I know there's a lot of good books out there. And I hope.
Well, name a couple of favorites, if you could.
Well, I'm looking at that. It's in the rear here, and I can see the bell curve. Very good book. What have we got here? The Israel Lobby, Mearsheimer Wall. Excellent book. Excellent book. Strongly recommended. And I've got a lot of European population genetics. You see E.L. Wilson's book in the back there, Sociobiology, had a big influence on me in the 1970s. Put me on this evolutionary perspective where, you know, I take seriously the idea that we are declining in population compared to others, and that is natural selection against us. I'm an evolutionist. I oppose that.
Kevin, there's been a comment that is rather a question. I don't know why we're getting feedback all of a sudden. A question that's come up in the chat room a couple of times. The BDS law. Are you familiar with that? The BDS movement, I believe it's really taken root in South Carolina, which discriminates against the people. Are you familiar with BDS?
Yes.
All right, explain it and explain your position on it.
Yeah, that's the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. Is
right. Yeah, there you go.
A peaceful way to put pressure on the Israel. And of course, it's combated tooth and nail by the Israel lobby. And it's made headway. You know, it started like 10 years ago. Very gradual, and they fought back all kinds of ways, including trying to pass laws, I think, like you mentioned, in South Carolina. But it's having an effect, I think, but gradually. But the fact is, the Israel lobby is not as monolithically powerful as it used to be. And what we're seeing especially is dissent from the left. And you talk to someone like Alan Dershowitz, and his amazing, in the wake of the Pittsburgh shootings a week or so ago, the serious Zionists were saying, you know, anti-Semitism, you know, it doesn't just come from these right-wing crazy guys. It comes from the left. They're very worried about that. You look at the Labour Party in the UK, very strongly anti-Israel, Jeremy Corbyn. But apparently only half the Democrats in this country really are pledging allegiance to Israel. But, you know, it's still a long ways because the people with money still run the show, and predominantly the money is still pro-Israel. So we'll see what happens. But the BDS is just part of a very broad movement. You know, really realizing Israel is not anything like what liberal Jews are advocating in America. It is an ethno state, very stridently aggressive ethno state. And, you know, they're seizing land. They have two sets of laws, basically. You know, it's a fascist state, basically. It's indefensible if you're on the left.
Kevin, this may be the best question of the night, and I hate to pick and choose because they've all been good. Do you think it's possible that whites recover from the negative effects of individualism? And I would add to that the negative effects of psychological altruism, which you've so effectively written about.
Yeah, I think that the whites have to be aware, first of all, of what our vulnerabilities are. And we have to, you know, whites are not completely devoid of mechanisms to have cohesive group. Done it before. Under religion, the Reconquista, religion, but also in the present day world, I think just sort of being aware of the situation. Like I said, when whites are told you're going to become a minority, they get worried about these things. And they, and when you get worried, when you feel threatened, you join groups. And so you, and that's what, you know, psychologically, that is part of our evolved psychology. It's called social identity theory. You join groups, and prefer, in this case, it's going to be a group based on race, because we are under the gun here. And so we are going to do this. And you see this, you know, more and more all the time. People are identifying more as white and having a sense of white interest. So I think that it, that's the wave of the future. But it's already happening. And that's what's really worrying. They see this going on now. And they're not unaware of these studies showing what happens when white people start feeling threatened. They don't just start moving away, because there's going to be a point, and really there is already, where you can't really move away from it. So push is coming to shove. We are living through the most, who thought that, you know? When I was a liberal back in the 60s, I envisioned an America that was fairer, nicer, and all that than it was now in the 60s. But I did not, and I don't think any liberal anticipated an America that was dramatically changed beyond all recognition in terms of the demographics. And that's what we see. This is a complete revolution, really.
Kevin, our chat was nothing if not receptive, and they asked, is that David Duke's My Awakening in the bottom left corner of your bookshelf?
It's there.
Hey, you know what? I know David. David's a good friend of mine. Let me tell you how you do not betray a brother, ladies and gentlemen, and never betray a brother. So often when I'm attacked in the media, they'll bring up the fact that David Duke has been a guest on my show. That's and right. I'll say, well, you know, David Duke's been a guest on everybody's show, including Wolf Blitzer, but I don't see you attacking him. But that's the easy way out for me to say that. Let me tell you what really is, what you really should know, is that not only has David Duke been a guest on my program, he's been a guest in my home. He has shared meals with my family, with my wife and children, and we have shared meals at his home. He is a very good friend, and that's how you end. And so I say, I want you to be clear when you write the hit piece that you're going to write. Don't just write that he's been a guest on my show. Write that James Edwards says that he's a very good friend of his, because he is, and so is Kevin, and so is so many other people out there. That is what a man does. A man does not betray his brother. A man does not betray a friend. And we would do better as a group if we would adhere to that standard. Would you agree?
I agree totally. And he's routinely vilified. The fact is, I don't see anything significant that he differs in terms of the beliefs from me. But it's still. I just saw something today. What was it? They said that this person had the same view that David Duke did, you know, or something, you know, and that somehow is enough to defeat it. I think Steve King, an Iowa representative, you know, that's how I'm trying to get him. You know, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, Steve King is Hitler now, according to the media. Well, and that's the thing. There's no middle ground anymore. We saw it with Gavin McInnes recently. Yes. There's no middle ground. I mean, if you're anywhere to the right of Stalin, you're a Nazi. You're a white supremacist, you're an anti-Semite, you're all of these things that they say that we are. And so people need to realize that you cannot run for cover anymore, and you might as well be honest about what you really believe, and you might as well join the ranks and wear the colors and fly the flag, because they're going to put you in that camp whether you want to be or not, and at least you'll have a community, at least you'll have people who will back you up, because your cucked out friends won't.
I know, that's right.
Last question, and it is almost time for us to stop. This comes from Jim in the chat room, and this brings us back full circle now, I guess, to the beginning of the interview and the reason why we're all here, to promote the Occidental Quarterly, TOQLive.com, the Occidental Quarterly. Go to TOQLive.com, TOQLive.com/membership, and order a subscription, send in a contribution. We need your support. Support the work of Dr. McDonald, and we'll continue to do these shows the first Sunday of every month right here on YouTube. But last question for you, Kevin, is who founded of the Occidental Quarterly, and what was its history before you became editor?
Well, it was, I think it's a project of the Paris Motel Society. It's a group of people who've gotten together. We have conferences once a year, usually. I'd say that the person who really started all this is Bill Regner, and he's pretty well known, and he's still involved. Definitely a good guy. The first editor, I believe, was Kevin Lamb, probably, and then I think Greg Johns was editor, and then I became editor. So they say that's kind of history now, but we're still going strong.
18th year and going strong, even with the platforming and even with all of the obstacles and hurdles that they would put in front of us in our path, we're still here. And it is because of those hurdles that we are here tonight on this particular YouTube venue, TOQ Live, toqlive.com. Folks, last missive is go there. Subscribe to the journal. If you don't want the journal, and you should, but if you don't, contribute anyway. To the work that we do here with the Occidental Quarterly. It is a beautiful, well-written, well-edited journal, to be sure, but it also has aesthetic qualities in that it is professionally produced. It's not something that is cheaply done. It's you see it, so you know. And that can be in your mailbox in a few days if you go to toqlive.com/membership and subscribe to the journal. Or donate, and if you prefer to get it the e-version, we do have those. We can mail it to you digitally. We can get it to you any way you want. Kevin, final word to you, my friend, and you are a friend.
It's great talking with you this way. As you say, we've never really done this long a time, but it's been very interesting and very good. I loved it.
At least not with interruptions and with all the audience feedback. Kevin, what would you like to say to all of those gathered in the chat room today?
Thanks really appreciate your involvement. And I hope we got to your questions. If we didn't, we'll try. I'll probably be on at some point later.
I'll come on next month.
Right. It's very important to support Occidental Quarterly. It's a vital niche. It's unique. And we need something like this in the intellectual world.
All right, folks, if you have any additional questions after we go dark tonight, go to toqlive.com. And if you want to send us an email, we have a staff on hand who will respond to you and answer all of your questions. And that email address is support@toqlive.com. support@toqlive.com. Kevin, Godspeed, my friend. Can't wait to talk to you again. And, of course, the day can't come soon enough when we see each other again. And we do get the opportunity to see each other a few times a year, and it's always a great time.
Yep. Have a drink. Enjoy.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Kevin McDonald, everybody. TOQLive.com. I'm James Edwards. More information about me, thepoliticalcesspool.org. For Kevin, theoccidentalobserver.net, and TOQLive.com. Good night, everybody.